Accession number 7396, row number 6.
Colonel Hancock, row 6. Could you describe in any way a typical day at Gallipoli in the front line?
Yes, fairly well. When we were in the front line, every morning, an hour before dawn, we had what is known as the Stand 2. Stand 2 was that every man must be alert, have all his equipment, and be ready in case there should be an attack by the enemy, which was the favourite time for that sort of thing to happen, Stand 2. That was a very good opportunity for officers to go round their platoon. I'm talking as a second lieutenant platoon commander, to go round my platoon to see that every man had got his equipment properly, that he really was alert, and he got his ammunition there and in fact ready to repel an attack. And that was the start. Well, we stood to until it was light, until such time as we could have seen an enemy coming. Then I imagine, depending on the circumstances and how things were going, we probably had some sort of breakfast, which meant tea being sent up from the cooks in Dix's. Each man, of course, had their mess tin and that sort of thing, and they probably had some biscuits and jam or something like that. The everlasting apricot jam. For years after it, I could never eat apricot jam, or bear to see a tap running, left running. But then I would go round to see that at that time, from the very first go, I was always the bombing officer for my company, and I was responsible for seeing that what bombs we had, no damn few, were in the proper places. And there were certain caches, so to speak, of the bombs dotted about our front line. And it was my job to see that they were always there. Or the supply was what we could scrape together. Then I would be up and down the trench, practically on the go all the time, to see that. To see that if there's any casualties, to see that they would stretcher bearers carried them off and got them to the field dressing station, or just to, if it's nothing very much, for a medical officer to attend to. Then I imagine we had some sort of midday meal, but I can't remember. I don't remember any particular time for having meals. That was the kind of thing that went on most of the day. You were always, of course, on the alert. You were always listening to hear if shells were coming or likely to come in your direction. You did a certain amount of surveying the Turkish trench nearest to you, opposite you, through a periscope, which you could do. And not infrequently, those periscopes used to be smashed to pieces. The Turks would see the periscope come out over the trench and they'd shoot it. That sort of thing. There was something going on all the time. Then we had an evening meal, I think, somewhere about 5 o'clock. And that was the main sort of meal of the day, when we got a stew sent up. So on very rare occasions, we used to get a bit of meat which had been cooked and sent up, but not very often. We rather would have had stew which had a certain amount of water with it. It was liquid that we were lacking all the time. And then we begin to sort of prepare for the night. Again, we had a stand to in the evening, which is another possible time or likely time for an attack. And that was it. But a lot of it was, it wasn't very active, if you know what I mean, except mentally. You had to keep your wits about you all the time, but physically, you didn't do an awful lot of it. There's nowhere to go that could be safe, except walking up and down out of the trench. And so on. And keeping a tally on one's platoon to see that all the men were accounted for, that they hadn't perhaps gone to the latrine and been taken ill or missing or might have been hit when out of the trench or something like that. It was a very rather boring, really, and it went on and on day after day, and we felt we weren't getting anywhere. We were just existing and surviving. A certain amount of work went on all the time in the way of deepening the trenches. That was a great thing, was to get the trench deep enough so that you felt comparatively safe, anyway. And that you hadn't got to keep bobbing down every few yards because there was a shallow bit of trench, which if you didn't, you'd get your head blown off. But that was the usual sort of thing.
You presumably had sentries
Oh, yes.
All through the day and through the night. How many would you have?
At certain points. Oh, I can't remember now. We had a machine gun post on our left and a machine gun post on our right. Then they would probably have a sentry, I imagine, at each of those posts, observing through a periscope. In between, I wouldn't know. I just don't know. But there were certainly specific places where a lookout was kept.
This went on through the night as well?
Oh, yes, yes. You see, the great thing was never to be taken by surprise. That was a great thing. And you had to keep your senses alert and your sight as far as you could see anything, and listening to hearing anything going on. It was, as I say, it was a stalemate by that time.
As a second lieutenant, did you have to inspect the night sentry posts, and did you ever find if there were people asleep?
No. They were, I must say, they were very, very aware of their duty, always. I thought they were magnificent, really, because a sentry's job is a rotten thing. You can't move. You've got to be watching all the time, and it's not difficult to fall asleep. But I never knew of a case.
As a second lieutenant, you're often given other duties. I believe you were once placed in charge of an ammunition dump, or the ammunition dump.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little about that?
Yes, now that was well behind the lines, and I think it would have been somewhere again in the Greenhill area, and there was a dump of ammunition formed at a reasonably safe place, the ammunition was landed on the beach from ships. The Sikhs, the Indians, used to bring that up from the beach in mule carts, at night, of course, in mule carts, and it was collected at this ammunition dump. It was in a sort of three sides of a square. I used to sleep on the top. Fortunately, I didn't get a shell then. Might have been a bit awkward. And I remember the Sikhs, they were splendid chaps, I thought. And I remember on one occasion seeing them cook their Geppettis. And I was fascinated with these things. And that, of course, a Geppetti was a great treat, and they gave me some, and that's right. I thought they were pretty decent chaps. But I felt that it wasn't their way of living, that kind of thing. I think they were splendid chaps to have taken it on. I really do. That didn't last very long, but I should think I was fortnight probably, something like that. And I remember, for what reason I don't quite know, but the whole time I was there I never shaved. I can't think why. It wasn't a very extensive growth, but just one of those little things that I happen to remember.
You mentioned earlier that you were always your company bombing officer. That you had to responsibility to check the bomb caches. I'd like to know a little about your duties, your other duties as company bombing officer, and also the extension of these duties when you became, I think it was brigade bombing officer.
Yes, that was afterwards. Each brigade, that is sort of four battalions, each had a bombing officer who was responsible for the bomb supply to that particular section which the brigade was occupying, and of the supply of the bombs and general distribution as to where they would be most likely to be wanted. Well, I had a fair bit of training as my company bombing officer, It was my job to use what rather small supply of bombs to the best effect. And in other words, be as big a nuisance to the Turks as we could. And every now and again, I would say that we'd lob a few bombs over to that part over there. I probably had two chaps with me, and they would have these bombs lined up behind me. I did the throwing always, and they were pretty crude sort of bombs. I remember three types. One was what we called a jam tin, which was rather like a 1 pound tin of jam, into which was put a charge of explosive of some kind, might be jagnite, might be dynamite, whatever. Then a fuse was inserted into a detonator. The head, the neck of the detonator was crimped together to hold the fuse into the detonator. It was put in through the top of the lid, through a hole in the top of the lid, down into the explosive. Then you've got probably 4 or 5 inches of fuse exposed. In order to use it, you would hold it in one's left hand, I think. I wouldn't be quite sure about this, but the thing was that to light the fuse, you had to be darn careful not to show a light at night, if it is at night. And often I would use the end of my cigarette. We're always smoking. And that was very effective. And then as soon as you heard it begin to fizz, keep it for about 2 or 3 seconds, not too long, but not too soon either. Otherwise, after you'd thrown it, you tried to get it to explode on landing. Now, it wouldn't be in the air very long, but you had to try and get your timing right. And you hoped it dropped into the trench. You couldn't see, but you heard the thing go off. Now, there are two other kinds I remember. One was what called a cricket ball, and it was about the size of a cricket ball. It was a cast iron thing shaped round with a hole in the top. It had been previously filled again with an explosive of some sort. Again, you primed it with a detonator and a fuse down through the hole in there. And exactly the same thing you used through it, as you would you burning it over arm, lobbing it over in the, into the trench, which wasn't very far away. And you hoped you got there. And that was that. And of course, when it exploded, the detonator, the cast iron broke into little bits, you see, and it was the fragments which did the damage. To the Turks, you hoped. Otherwise, a thing called a hairbrush. And it was a thing, a flat piece of wood, about 6 inches square, perhaps, with a handle at the end. Onto that slab of wood was tied a piece of dynamite, which had a very local but very effective, had a very, very local, I'm sorry, I'm getting this wrong. The explosion was very local, but very intense. And you primed that in much the same way. And you threw that. That was a good thing to throw, because you got a handle to throw it by. And one got quite good at that. Those are the only three distinct types I remember. Now, another source of our bombs were the Turkish jam tins. Now, they were extremely badly done, badly finished. They were the same principle as ours, which was a tin, and it was filled with all kinds of odds and ends of bits of stone, flint, old cartridges, expended cartridges, empty cartridges, bits of iron, nails, anything in that tin. They had exactly the same thing. They had a fuse into a detonator, pushed inside, lit it and threw it over. I should think 30% of them failed to go off. And we heard them fall, and if they didn't go off within a certain amount of we marked it down, there's a dud there. And we had to guess more or less where it was, couldn't see it. And then, at night, I used to go out, and sometimes I used to have someone with me, crawling about in a little bit of no man's land, collecting these damn things. And they were a very good source of ammunition. I mean, we were damn short of these things. And all I had to do was to take the fuse out, which hadn't burnt through, take that out, re-fuse with a detonator on the end, and chuck it back. And they always went off. Highly satisfactory sound. But that was very much a nighttime job. And that was my job as a brigade, as a company bombing officer.
And this function changed more into an organisational role when you became brigade?
Well, I had to do the same thing, only on a doubly wide front line. You see, our battalion manned one section. The other battalion of our brigade would be on our right. So you've got the two battalions, a stretch of front line. So it doubled my job as far as that was concerned. And it was my job to see that the people in the other battalion knew what they were doing. Rather cheek, I must say, but they seemed quite willing to accept me for that. And that's how we went on.
Was there any other bombing conducted? The company and battalion bombing officers, did anybody else do bombing? I mean, was there a or
In our battalion?
Yes. Did anybody else do the bombing?
No.
Just you?
No, never. Never. I'm not sure they were allowed to, because I had to keep such a careful grip on our supplies. And sometimes we didn't get any up for a long time. And we felt so defenceless.
When you threw the bombs over the Turkish lines,
yeah.
Did this attract any response from the Turkish lines? And if so, what sort of response?
Yes, it did. Well, if we started up, we thought we might have a bit of fun, chuck a few bombs over. And the Turks said, oh, well, if you can do that, all right. We can just be just as nasty. And then they started throwing the stuff at us. And we got quite a little bit of aggro going. On one occasion, I was in the a little bomb bay, so to speak, a little sort of a place sort of hollowed out, specially from which one threw bombs. And I was right up underneath our front line, up against the trench. And without my knowing it, a Turkish bomb got in there, right beside me. And the bloody thing went off. Well, it knocked me flat. And I, just for a moment, I wasn't knocked out, but I wondered what the hell's happened. And I can't think why. I'd missed it. I don't know. Somehow it had trickled over the top, I suppose, and dropped down beside. I wasn't killed, I can't imagine. But it was one of their jam tins, and it exploded into no end of tiny little fragments of tin. And I had got some in my cheek here, my left cheek, and I had it in little bits in there for ages afterwards. I'm not sure, I didn't find a piece in there even after I got back to England. But at the time, it made a bit of a mess of my face, but it wasn't serious. It was only just skin deep. And these tiny little bits got in there, and if I was shaving, I'd catch against it. But why? I can't think why I wasn't killed.
Were you on your own on that occasion? Was anybody else in the bay with you?
Nobody else in the bay with me, no, because there's only room for one person to fire from me. And I got probably some chap with me there handing in the bombs to me, and I'd light the thing and chuck them. That's how it worked. But I must say that was a very, very near shave.
Were there many casualties caused by a Turkish bombing of your trenches?
Oh, yes, quite a bit. They used to come over. You never knew, you see. It's one of the things that you had to be constantly on the alert for, was a bomb suddenly landing in your trench. And I've seen these bombs land on some occasions, and the chap scattered either way like hell to get out of it. And as soon as he'd gone off, they explained, it's all right, you come back in. But he didn't always get away. And that went on all the time, the whole blooming time.
During the night as well?
Oh, yes, yes. And that's why one's nerves were rather taut, which was, tiring in itself, the mental strain of it.
Just to move on now to sniping. You've described sniping at a sandbag
with a telescope rifle, yes.
To just try and annoy the Turks by
breaking. That was only pure annoyance and just bloody mindedness.
Could you describe sniping operations on either side? Let's firstly take our sniping. Did we have picked snipers, and was anybody in charge of them?
Not that I know. No, I never had anything to do with that. But that was a great thing. One of the great things about the Turks, they had a tremendous number of snipers, which had well concealed places where they'd lie up perhaps for days. And we tried to pinpoint them sometimes by the flash of their rifle. But it was a very difficult thing. But that was where the Australians were, so marvellous. They were, they're loners, the Australians, you know. They used to go out at night with a rifle, having, as they thought, pinpointed some sniper's point. And they would go out there and try and winkle them out. I thought it was the bravest thing. And they'd come back over the top of the trench just before dawn in the light. My God, I think that was brave. But that was their temperament. They were individualists.
So to be a sniper, really, it was just, would anybody who wanted to be a sniper just take his rifle or get a periscope rifle and set to?
Yes. Well, I used to use his periscope rifle with my company commander, and he used to come around and say, look here, let's have a go at that sandbag placed just down the end of this trench, which had been sandbagged off. I think there's a machine gun there. And we used to try and make nuisances of ourselves.
Did you actually ever hit the Turks? Did British sniping ever result in Turkish casualties, do you feel?
I think I did on one occasion, yes I do. Because the at Stand 2, before it got light, we were standing up on the fire step and you could look over the top of the trench. Now the hill towards the Turks sloped up slightly and the sun rose behind them. Now they couldn't see us, but we could see them. And I remember on one occasion firing at what I thought was a Turk. It was just light. The light was just behind him. I knew I was in the shade. And his woolly cap blew off. I reckon I got that one.
Were you using a periscope rifle or
no,
rifle?
No, because it was, it wasn't quite light. But we always had that. That was the only time we ever had any advantage as far as the contours of the land was concerned. I remember that one very well.
How many people used to indulge in sniping?
Oh, not a great many. Not a great many.
Any number you could put on it?
It wasn't a sort of... No. It was only an occasional sniping shot like that I remember. It wasn't nearly such a... a normal practice, if you like to call it, as the Turks used to make of it. They did a lot of it. But they, of course, they knew the land, you see, they knew the ground. It was their country, after all, we were invading, and they knew where they were and what, how to hide up.
Did they cause many casualties?
I think they did earlier on, until we learnt to conceal ourselves properly. Yes, I do. But the Australians had suffered from it more than we had. By the time we got to Hill 60, the thing was settling down into more of a stalemate. There wasn't so much